Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a free ebook for you to download today that you won't want to miss. It's called In Conversation with Jordan Peterson, Atheism, Christianity, and the Psychology of Belief. This special ebook was created from an unbelievable podcast with famed Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson. And in it, you'll discover how to bring order to a chaotic world using the wisdom of the Bible. So download your free copy of In Conversation with Jordan Peterson by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. This is a limited time offer, so make sure to do it today. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Good afternoon and welcome along to Unbelievable. I'm Justin Brierley. This is the programme that brings you different perspectives for conversations that matter every single week. Listen to around the world at our website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable, where you can find details of the podcast, resources and loads of other interesting stuff as well. And it won't have escaped your notice if you're a regular listener to Unbelievable that Saturday, the 19th of May, today's show is in fact, of course, Unbelievable, the conference as well. So today's show is very much a pre-recorded one and a fascinating discussion today between Lydia McGrew and Craig Evans on the historical aspects of John's Gospel. But if you're listening to the podcast edition of the programme today, which releases on the Friday evening, you may just be in time still to pick up some tickets for the Unbelievable conference. They're still available from the website if that's the case for you. Or you can literally rock up on the day itself on Saturday. premier.org.uk/just ask. Your very last call for tickets to this year's Unbelievable conference. And on next week's programme, we'll be bringing you some highlights from the day. And everyone who's at the conference will be getting a very special sneak preview of the Big Conversation film series that we've been working on hard here at Unbelievable. And if you're a podcast listener, you'll also get a preview of that in the coming week as well. And you'll be hearing much more about it on future editions of the show. Later on here on Unbelievable, Johnny Somerville will also be joining me to talk about a new film series called Newer, helping people to engage with the claims of Christianity. And he's also an exhibitor at this year's Unbelievable conference. So lots to look forward to in today's show. Let's get into our discussion. You're unbelievable. Well, today on the programme, we're asking, does John's Gospel present a historically accurate picture of Jesus? Craig Evans is a distinguished New Testament scholar, currently serving as Professor of Christian Origins at Houston Baptist University. His books include Jesus, the Final Days, What Really Happened with N.T. Wright, and most recently, Jesus and the Remains of His Day, Studies in Jesus and the Evidence of Material Culture. You can find out more about Craig, his many books, articles and activities in historical biblical studies at craigaevans.com. Now, Craig has been involved in a number of dialogue events over the years, and back in 2012, he debated sceptical New Testament scholar Bart Ehrman on the question of whether the Gospels provide a historically reliable portrait of Jesus. However, it's only recently that some of the statements Craig made in that dialogue have provoked consternation in some quarters of the evangelical church. Critics claim that Craig questioned the fundamental historical reliability of John's Gospel. Well, one of those critics is Lydia McGrew. Lydia is a widely published analytic, philosopher, blogger, and wife of philosopher and apologist Tim McGrew, who's also been on this show in the past. Now, recently, Lydia has also focused on issues around New Testament reliability. In fact, she and Tim co-wrote the article on the resurrection of Jesus for the Blackwell Companion to Natural Theology. And last year, she published Hidden in Plain View, Undesigned Coincidences in the Gospels and Acts. She was on this programme talking about it. And that defends the reliability of the New Testament using a long-neglected argument from incidental details. More about Lydia and her books at lydiamcgrew.com. And in the context of this programme, Lydia believes that Craig has given away too much ground to sceptical views of the historicity of the Gospel of John. So today we're going to be allowing Craig to lay out exactly what he does and doesn't think we can take from the Gospel of John when it comes to the historical Jesus. And Lydia will be responding. So a very warm welcome to you both, Lydia and Craig.
Thanks for having us, Justin.
Thank you.
It's great to have you both join me on the show today. Craig, I think your second time you've joined me on the show, it was some time back now that we were doing a discussion on Islam and Jesus and ISIS and that kind of thing. But coming on to debate something and talk about something quite different today, You've been involved a long time now in historical studies on Jesus. Particularly recently, I know a lot of your focus has been on the Dead Sea Scrolls. You've been involved in a number of exciting finds and things like that. There are some interesting things going on at the moment in that area, aren't there?
Oh, yes. We continue to make discoveries and continue to publish this very rich trove of material from the Dead Sea, and it's what it's been so good about it. It clarifies everything in the New Testament. That's not really an exaggeration. And so it sheds light on James, Hebrews, Paul's letters, especially works of the law, for example, and a number of important teachings in Jesus and the Gospels. One of the Dead Sea Scrolls, I think, decisively shows that Jesus indeed did have a messianic self-understanding in his reply to John the Baptist. Another scroll shows, I think, again, decisively with respect to the Annunciation in Luke 1, that the expectation of a Messiah who would be called Son of God is indeed a pre-Christian idea. It's not something that occurred to the church later when they were preaching Jesus as the Messiah and encountered the Greco-Roman world, which talked about sons of God. So it's just things like that. Mm. And the scrolls, like archaeology, over and over again show that the gospel writers knew what they were talking about. They're describing the real Jesus of the first century Jewish Palestine and not some later fiction.
Mm, mm. And from everything you've just said there, it's evident that you have a lot of confidence in the Gospels, in their historical provenance and so on. But just give us a sense of what transpired, in your view, in this debate you had with Bart Ehrman several years ago now. Because I know that, you know, a number of people have flagged up concerns with some of what you said around the Gospel of John. We'll get to the specifics of that. Do you want to give us, though, the context of what this debate was, or what exactly you were discussing, and what it is you kind of pointed out when it comes to the synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, compared to the Gospel of John?
Well, I think the backdrop with that debate with Bart Ehrman, I think the title had something to do with, are the Gospels reliable? And he was arguing, no, they're not. And I was arguing, yes, yes, they are. But what I find in debating Bart is he likes to take a very fundamentalist pose, which he, of course, rejects. And Bart likes to keep it as black and white as possible. And so either you have a very naive and uncritical understanding of the Gospels, as if to say it's videographed, audio recorded history of what Jesus said and did. And if that's true, and then when you find these discrepancies where the wording is not identical, and sometimes even the locations appear to be different when you compare the parallels, then you have a big problem. And that was the tact that he was taking, tried to make it sound like either you embrace word for word everything and don't see any contradictions or discrepancies or anything at all, or you concede that the Gospels are not reliable, that they're full of contradictions, mistakes, dubious history, and so on. That was his tactic, and in my debates with him since, I think he's nuanced it a little better. He knows it's difficult to get away with that, at least when he's debating with me. And how I'm responding to that, and this is where some Christians I don't think quite get it, but Bart should know, and I think he in private probably does know, that the way history was written 2,000 years ago was a bit different, and the pedagogical goals of Jesus were not the same as ours today. And that's just not well understood. But we're not guessing here. We actually have the educational handbooks from antiquity. We know how people were taught, how people would take the teachings of the great ones, the philosophers, the great teachers, and memorize their teaching and package it, so to speak, in a way that could communicate effectively with diverse audiences, perhaps even in different languages. And that's what I was dealing with. And I think the Gospel of John exhibits some of those characteristics. And that's why John is so different from the Synoptics. But But that same observation explains why Matthew, Mark, and Luke are not identical either. Mm. And so when we talk about the Gospels as historically reliable, we can say, yes, indeed, they are. They give us a very true portrait of the historical Jesus, but there are these interpretive elements at work, which Jesus himself told his own disciples to do. And so this is not a question of faulty memory or just wild imagination, making up stuff, that sort of thing. That's not my position. I think the Gospel of John is indeed historical, but it's a mixture. It's not just history, but it's also interpretation. And I think that's what caused some problems with some conservative listeners.
We'll obviously see. We will bring Lydia in at this point to talk about that. But effectively, yes, you felt there was a false dichotomy being painted by Bart. You think there is a more nuanced way of understanding the Gospels within their own genre, within their own time, that does not negate their historical reliability. Let's cross to Lydia now, Lydia, because it was really you were the one who was interested in discussing this with Craig, and I know that this Craig isn't the only person with whom you've obviously disagreed on the length to which they perhaps question some of the historical reliability of aspects of the Gospel of John and so on. I think Mike Lacona, you've also had some interactions with on this. So what are your main concerns here, Lydia, coming to this yourself?
Right. Well, one thing I would like to discuss is that I do feel that in what Craig is saying right here, right now, he's making John sound more like the Synoptic Gospels than what he has implied in the past. And so, for example, I'd like to zero in a little bit on that statement about John being a mix of interpretation and history. There was definitely a sense that John is in a completely different category from the Synoptics and some of the discussion with Bart. It wasn't just a matter of some of these ideas that Craig has concerning even the Synoptic Gospels, that they felt free to expand on the teachings of Jesus. We might disagree about that, too. In fact, I suspect that we do. But there was a pretty strong distinction. So, for example, in that discussion, Craig, you said concerning the I Am statements, and particularly before Abraham was I Am, you said this aspect of the Gospel of John I would not put into the category of historical. It's a genre question. And, for example, you said the Johannine statements, the distinctive ones, with a few exceptions, they're the ones that look like, as I said earlier, a different genre altogether, that something that only incidentally has historical material in it, but otherwise it's a completely different type of literature. And you said that some of these look like places where the, as you called it, Johannine community has dramatically recreated things that were not historically said by the historical Jesus in a recognizable fashion, but that reflected their own theological reflections. And you contrasted that with the Synoptics very strongly. So I think we can get to your views of John by moving beyond this notion of pedagogic practices of the time, which you would apply to the Synoptics as well, to this distinction that you're wanting to draw between them. And I would like to get you to, you know, state clearly what your position is concerning the historicity of, for example, the dialogue where Jesus is talking to the Jewish people and ends it by saying, before Abraham was, I am, and then they throw stones. And I just want to clarify before you answer that, I am not asking whether John recorded these things word for word or verbatim, but I am asking whether that incident occurred in addition to any incidents in the Synoptics in a historically recognizable fashion.
I mean, you've leapt right in there, Lydia. Before we do come to Craig for some responses to that, what for you in a broader sense what kind of difference does this make? Why for you is it so important that we do understand John as having a very real, if you like, historical pedigree in terms of these are not, in a sense, recreated episodes or in any sense simply formed out of a Johannine community or whatever, that these really do relate to historical things that Jesus did and said What stands or falls?
Rather than three Gospels, let me put it that way. I think it's a great thing that we have the Gospel of John, and I think the Gospel of John is historical throughout. I think it displays its historicity everywhere. I don't think it switches on and off like, oh, I'm historical now. Oh, now it's allegory or something like that. It's historical throughout, and it's important just because there's great material in there, and it's giving us additional material that we do not find in the Synoptic Gospels. So we want to know what the historical Jesus did and said and who he was, what his teaching was. And I think John does give us that, and it gives us material that's not simply duplicating what's in the Synoptics. So when someone appears to be saying that where John is unique, he is really representing the reflections of a community rather than incidents that occurred with the historical Jesus, and I think that's false, then I want to actually come in and challenge that and say, no, I think that's false. I think we have evidence to the contrary, and it's a good thing for us to have this fourth historical gospel giving us this additional material. Obviously, we want to know what Jesus said.
I was going to say that one, particularly among more conservative scholars who, you know, subscribe to a particular view of inerrancy, that I know that they've had concerns with some of the things Craig and other scholars have said in this regard, because they don't think you should be able to treat the Gospels differently to them being sort of, you know, effectively reported speech in that way.
Well, that's not where I'm coming
from. But you're not coming from there, because you don't actually hold that position yourself, do you? I just want to be
correct.
Clear on this, yeah.
I think I want to be very clear about that. I think the documents are very reliable. And my concerns here are historical and evidential. I think there's ample evidence that that the Gospel of John is historical in nature everywhere, again, not switching on and off, and is highly reliable as an individual source for Jesus' life and teachings. And I'm glad we have the Gospel, so I'm defending that, not because of a commitment to inerrancy. That's correct.
Well, let's before we come back to you, Craig, just give a shout out for any listener who would like to get in touch about today's discussion. I'm sure there'll be a lot of interesting responses to what we're talking about today. If you'd like to send in an email, do email unbelievable@premier.org.uk, or you can share your thoughts via our social media at UnbelievableJB for the show on Twitter, or facebook.com/UnbelievableJB to follow us on Facebook. You can find all those details and more. Leave comments underneath today's show at the website too. PremierChristianRadio.com/unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
So today on the program, we're asking, does John's Gospel present a historically accurate picture of Jesus? My two guests for this inter-Christian dialogue today on the historical basis of the Gospel of John are Craig Evans, distinguished New Testament scholar, currently serving as Professor of Christian Origins at Houston Baptist University, and Lydia McGrew, who has criticised Craig recently for statements he made in an interaction with Bart Ehrman, a sceptical New Testament scholar, a few years ago, in which Craig appeared to suggest that the Gospel of John was not as historical in many respects as the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark and Luke. I mean, a lot that Lydia brought up there, Craig, so I don't know where you want to begin. I don't know whether it would be worth looking at that central question she had around, well, what do you believe is the nature of the statements Jesus made in terms of the I am statements, and particularly that one before Abraham was I am. Now, is that something that Jesus said? Or is that something that, as it were put into his mouth by a later community, expressing more the tradition around him, in a sense? Where do you go with that?
Well, I think in the I am statements, you have Jesus's teaching, but not always his exact words. I didn't talk about before Abraham was I am, that particular statement in John 8. I don't recall that coming up with Bart Ehrman. I think if I remember correctly, Bart just asked me if the I am discourses, such as they were, represented the actual words of Jesus. And it was in the context of how do we account for John being so different from the Synoptics. And what I conceded in that conversation is that I did not think that the I am discourses, if you'd been there with Jesus running a tape recorder, I don't think you would have heard an I am discourse from top to bottom in that form.
And forgive me for interrupting, just for those who aren't as familiar as you are, obviously, with these texts, could you just remind us what some of those statements are in that I Am discourse.
Of course. And John's gospel, and this is one of the most distinctive features about John, is where Jesus just begins to speak at length. Nothing like this in the synoptics and Matthew, Mark, or Luke. But in John, Jesus will say, I am the light of the world, and he'll go on and on and on for many verses, or I am the bread of life, and he'll go on and on for many verses explaining what that means and in what sense he's the bread of life coming, you know, from heaven and everything else. I am the truth, I am the way, the truth, and the life. I am the resurrection of life. These are the, I'm the good shepherd. These are the I Am discourses. There are about seven of them. And they're very thematic. They're very theological. They have a very high Christology. And Jesus speaks more or less as wisdom speaks. If you compare, for example, in the book of Sirach, chapter 24, Sophia or wisdom speaks this way also. And this is why many scholars see the Gospel of John as something of a hybrid. It's sure, it's loaded with history. We have the historical Jesus, we have itinerary, we have places, real people, real events, including the threat to stone Jesus. We have probably important information about Jesus's ministry prior to the chronology that we find in the Synoptic Gospels. And so, John, I agree with many things Lydia has said, that John is an invaluable source for additional information, and that does explain a lot of the differences. It's supplemental, it's additional, it isn't simply covering the same ground as Matthew, Mark, and Luke. But there is this stylized speaking as wisdom for many, many verses in a row. And this is where scholars suspect that the evangelist or his community have taken Jesus's teaching and fashioned these lengthy discourses so that it's a teasing out in greater detail the actual meaning of Jesus's teaching as well as specific things that he said. The synoptic writers do that a little bit also, especially Matthew in creating these discourses, five major discourses in his gospel. But John seems to take it a step further and shapes the discourse in a way that it does sound like wisdom is speaking. And that's all, that was the only point I was trying to make to Bart Ehrman. Mm. I think he wanted me to try to defend or feel pressured to defend that the I Am discourses in John were verbatim, you know, word for word. And no, I didn't think so. They're interpretive. But that doesn't mean they don't reflect what Jesus actually taught.
Okay, Lydia, go ahead.
Yeah, I'd like to go ahead here. Craig, I just really want to say that two of the most notable statements that Jesus makes, which were explicitly addressed by Bart, were before Abraham was I Am and I and the Father are one. Neither of those takes place in the context of a lengthy discourse. Before Abraham was I Am takes place at the end of a dialogue that Jesus has with the people, and I and the Father are one takes place at the end of a very short discussion that is set in the portico of Solomon, where Jesus has talked about being the good shepherd and says no one can pluck them out of the Father's hand, and then he says, I and the Father are one, and in that case as well they take up stones to stone him. So neither of these is a lengthy discourse, and again, as I said before, I'm not asking whether you think that this is recorded verbatim. What I am asking, let's just take those two cases, and I'd just kind of like to get a clear yes or no. Do you think that those two incidents where Jesus was in these places, was having these discussions and these dialogues, and culminated by saying in the one case, before Abraham was I Am, and in the other case, I and the Father are one, and then they went to stone him. Do you think that those incidents where he said those things occurred in a recognizable way in history? What is your opinion on that?
No, I think they did. The only thing, again, to go back to the Bart Ehrman thing, had to do with the I Am discourses. He wasn't asking my opinion about the whole of the Gospel of John or about these specific sayings here where Jesus remarks in a way that angers people. We see that in the Synoptics also, where there are one-liners. Jesus says something or he's accused of something, and there are threats made. There's high Christology throughout Jesus's ministry. That's why at the top of the program I mentioned one of the scrolls from Qumran that I think now that it's been found, it's 4Q521, we realize Jesus' reply to the imprisoned John the Baptist was indeed a messianic reply. If I were to go further into that, the 4Q521 is alluding to one of the Psalms where it's describing the works of the Lord, Yahweh, the God of Israel. And so we realize not only is it a messianic reply to John on the part of Jesus, it is a very high Christology where he's basically claiming to do the very works of the Lord, the works of Yahweh. And that has encouraged scholars in the last 20 years, mostly evangelical scholars, to be sure, but it's encouraged scholars to start speaking about a very high Christology that's in the Synoptic Gospels, not just in John. And so I think that's very helpful, and it's narrowing the gap, you might say, in some ways, between John and the Synoptics. I just don't want to be misunderstood on this. What the whole point was, are the I Am discourses, the lengthy discourses, verbatim reports of what Jesus said? And I said, I don't think so, because of the pedagogical practices of the time, the way history was written, the way Jesus himself instructed his own disciples to interpret and apply his teaching.
And if I could cross to Lydia, you yourself, Lydia, have also said, actually, you don't think they are verbatim. But what do you think they are? What distinguishes what you think was at least said and what you think Craig thinks it has actually happened with these I Am discourses and statements?
Well, first of all, I just really disagree with this phrase, I Am discourses. And I also disagree, obviously, Craig probably hasn't rewatched the debate footage recently, but Bart definitely asked, did he say, I and the Father are one? He said that, asked specifically about that. He asked specifically about before Abraham was I Am. He did not simply ask about lengthy discourses. So I actually, think there's a little bit of recreation of history going on here. That's less important to me than the actual facts of the matter. As far as being or not being verbatim, that's really not a super important matter. For one thing, Jesus may have been speaking in Aramaic, so just to begin with, there would have to be some translation going on. Obviously, if it were before Abraham walked around in Canaan, I am, there can be these slight differences. The important point to me is that it's recognizable in history and that it occurs separately from what occurred in the Synoptics. So, for example, at that time, Craig was saying the Johannine sayings, the distinctive ones, with a few exceptions, they're the ones that look like, as I said earlier, a different genre altogether, something that only incidentally has historical material. He did not merely say the long discourses, though he also did discuss long discourses, but also Johannine sayings. Now, it's great if he's, changed his mind about that, but what I would want to say is that all of John shows this impact of history, and in fact, even the longest discourse, which is known as the farewell discourse in John, has these interesting crossovers with the synoptic material, and I have specifics on that, where Jesus is actually saying things there in a different context because it's at the Last Supper, but that are exact parallels to synoptic things. It's also possible that discourse is partly a composite, the way some people think the Sermon on the Mount may be a composite of putting some things together in one place that may originally have been said at a different time.
But what I'm hearing from you, Lydia, in that sense is that however you it's kind of put together and material is gathered, Jesus did say things that were of this nature, of this high Christology. These I Am sayings were said by Jesus,
recognizable, and particularly that when there are scenes that are different from anything in the synoptic, these unique scenes occurred, these unique sayings occurred in a recognizable way.
Well, we're running up to our first break, so I'm going to stop you there, Lydia. We'll come back with Craig's responses in the next part of today's program. You're listening to Unbelievable, where we get distinctive views together for dialogue and debate every week. We're doing a look at the historical reliability of the Gospel of John. Does it paint a historically accurate picture of Jesus, we're asking today? Craig Evans and Lydia McGrew join me on the show. Come back again in a short moment. Everyone's favourite satirist Adrian Plass pens a new sacred diary for the latest edition of Premier Christianity magazine with his unique take on the phenomenon of the Christian festival. Plus, we ask, how should believers respond to identity politics? Is smoking the cardinal sin it's often made out to be? Hugh Ross tells how astrophysics brought him face to face with the Creator, and we bring you a special report on the megachurch movement in the USA, going behind the scenes of six of America's biggest churches. All that plus much more. Ask for your free edition at premierchristianity.com/freesample.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to this second part of this week's Unbelievable. Asking today, does John's Gospel present a historically accurate picture of Jesus? Craig Evans and Lydia McGrew are my guests today for this theological and biblical debate. Craig is Distinguished New Testament Scholar, currently serving as Professor of Christian Origins at Houston Baptist University. He's many, many books and articles to his name. You can find out more about him at craigaevans.com. But we're talking today about his specific view of the Gospel of John, which has been one of the more debated of the Gospels. Scholars often term the Matthew, Mark and Luke as the synoptic Gospels, and John as a more theological account, really, of Jesus' life, teachings, death and resurrection. It were certain comments that Craig made in a discussion on this with Bart Ehrman that caused some people to have concerns over whether he was giving it enough weight in terms of the historical reliability of the Gospels. Lydia is among those who have had these concerns, and Lydia herself is widely published analytic philosopher, blogger, and most recently has been writing in the area of the reliability of the Gospels and Acts with her book Hidden in Plain View, Undesigned Coincidences in the Gospels and Acts. And we'll make sure that Lydia tells us about some of the ways in which she really believes the Gospel of John is actually stacked in ways often unrecognised with historical material. But coming back to you first of all, Craig, on this front, I mean, you've said already, actually, there's a lot you can agree with in what Lydia's saying about certain aspects of the historicity of John's Gospel. I think there is a difference, though, of opinion on these particular sayings, these I am statements. And regardless of whether which particular ones you were or weren't debating with Bart Ehrman, I think it's important for Lydia that even if the material has been perhaps arranged and it's not the exact words that were said and perhaps things have been brought together in some way, nevertheless, what they are reporting are claims that Jesus made of himself, that he did say in some fashion, I am the bread of life, I am the light of the world, I am the way, the truth and the life. Now, is it not so important for you that Jesus literally said those words, or whether they be in Aramaic or whatever, is it okay for a gospel to effectively put words into Jesus's mouth by, as it were, kind of adapting and in a sense theologizing the teaching that they are aware of in a historical sense?
Well, it's very important, and Jesus's teaching has to be understood correctly, and then what is said, how he is summarized or paraphrased or elaborated on, has to be true to the original intent and true to the entire context of his ministry and his teaching, and very true in the light of the Easter event. As a starting place, I go to Matthew 13:52, where after these parables on the King of God, he asks his disciples if they understand what he's taught, and they say they do. And then he goes on to say that the scribe, every scribe who is discipled, trained for the kingdom of heaven, knows how to pull out of his treasure box, literally, things that are new as well as things that are old. And I take that in step with the pedagogy of antiquity, where you really don't know your master's teaching if you simply repeat it word for word. Anybody can do that. A trained parrot can do that. But you demonstrate your knowledge, the fact that you've been discipled, that you truly have learned your master's teaching, when you are able to elaborate on it, expand it or contract it, link different sayings together, and it's called krea in the singular, krei in the plural. Papias, the early church father, early second century, actually uses that word in describing the teachings of Jesus compiled by Mark, the teachings passed on to him by Peter. And we see this is very much in play in the Synoptic Gospels. Now, in saying this, I'm not saying anything new. Scholars were making that observation 30 years ago. And I think we have something similar going on in John. The difference, though, is, and this is what we've been talking about, John is so different, and we don't have synoptic Johannine Gospels. We only have one. And we have three synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, so we can compare them. We can horizontally compare them, and we can see a multitude of differences. Most of them are very small, very minor, where the wording has been changed, or perhaps sometimes the saying is in a new location. And we, instead of having a crisis of faith or wondering, oh, what's going on here? These are contradictions. We have a very good idea of what's going on. And it's the pedagogy of the time at work, which Jesus himself enjoined on his disciples. That's what makes the Gospels so effective. And so we don't have just one Gospel. We have four. We have three synoptics that cover the same ground, essentially, and speak so well to three different settings, three different contexts, and apply the Domenical tradition so effectively. John is a bit of an outlier in that what makes John more complicated is John is used is using mostly wholly different material. And so that's why this discussion's a little bit complicated. We don't have a point of comparison in that sense. So when we look at Matthew, Mark, and Luke, we can see the same story in two or three of the Gospels, and we can actually see the changes in the wording, and that has to be accounted for. And those who say that, well, these changes represent mistakes or failures of memory, I think they are incorrect. That is not the right explanation for it. But when we see the differences in John that are of such magnitude compared to Matthew, Mark, and Luke, it's a little more difficult to sort that out and explain what's going on. Part of it is, as Lydia has said, it's simply different material, and I agree with that. I think a big chunk of it, as the early church fathers knew, was that it's actually previous ministry experience and teaching that that occurred before Jesus was baptized by John. That is part of it. And some of it is geographic. That is, John gives us a lot more material in the south, in Samaria and Judea and in Jerusalem. John even talks about visits to Jerusalem that are not recorded in Matthew, Mark, or Luke. So that does explain some of it. But once we make the observation that the evangelists did have the freedom, and I would argue the obligation, to reshape Jesus's teaching as Jesus himself taught them to do, I think that's what addresses this problem very well. And we have no reason then to have a crisis of confidence in the Gospels. I was just going to say the disciples were taught well, and it shows. And so we have truth. What we have in all four Gospels is what Jesus taught, even if we don't always have the exact words and in the same sequence and the same location.
So, as it were, the crayer removes the crisis in terms of the understanding the what was acceptable to do in terms of this reshaping and reframing of teaching and so on. And that's being done to some extent with other material, to some extent, in John's Gospel. Lydia, where do you want to begin with that? Because
I'd like to go to the distinction that Craig seems to be making between what he calls the long discourses in John and apparently what he's now admitting the distinct historicity of, which is those two places where Jesus said, before Abraham was, I am, and I am the Father of one, presumably because, as has been pointed out, they do not occur in the course of long discourses. And so now it appears that where he thinks John is distinctive from the synoptics, and again, I want to point out, Craig believes that this crea elaboration was allowed in the synoptics as well, but he also has emphasized very strongly a distinction with John, and even somewhat here in this conversation, concerning the so-called long discourses. So I'd like to address that a little bit. The distinction between John and the synoptics on the length of Jesus' discourses is to some extent an illusion and has been exaggerated. There is, with a Unitarian scholar named James Drummond in the early 1900s, he put together a chart showing that this idea that John has much longer discourses than the synoptics is actually false. Matthew actually has longer sections in which Jesus speaks uninterrupted. There are not lengthy I am discourses in the Gospel of John that are just like really long, and there's nothing that long in the synoptics. That's not true at all. The Sermon on the Mount is actually longer than any portion of the so-called farewell discourse in John that is not broken up by dialogue. Richard Baucom has also pointed out that the aphoristic style of Jesus in the synoptics may actually be the artifact, and that the more connected style of Jesus in, for example, the farewell discourse or the bread of life discourse may actually be more realistic. Now, Baucom himself is not saying that that's verbatim what Jesus said and might even think it's more contrived than what I think it is. But his point is that we should not take the choppy Jesus of the synoptics to be the historical Jesus and the connected Jesus of John to be ahistorical, that in fact it would look more realistic for him to speak in a connected fashion. I would also like to point out that this, and I'm just going to go to the so-called farewell discourse, because some of the ones that Craig has cast some question on here, such as that what are called the I am statements with a predicate, like I am the vine and you are the branches, so these kinds of things that occur allegedly in long discourses occur on that last night. That last night is confirmed by some of the undesigned coincidences I've discussed. For example, why did Jesus wash their feet? Because they were quarreling and squabbling. And what did Jesus mean in Luke by saying, I am among you as the one who serves? And then that's explained by the foot washing. And some of these discourses are interspersed with dialogue that he had with them in that night. So I think we do have reason. Again, there may be some composite going on there in that period from John 14 through 16, but I don't think we have reason to believe that that passage is any more expanded or the words of the Yohanan community or anything like that than what is in the Synoptic Gospels. And in fact, here's a really interesting parallel that I found. In Matthew 7:7, we have the famous, ask and it shall be given unto you, seek and you shall find, knock and the door shall be opened unto you. In John 16:24, which is right smack in the middle of one of these so-called long Yohanan discourses, Jesus says, until now you have asked nothing in my name, ask and you shall receive. Similarly, Mark 13:13, again, a different setting, a different context. He says, you will be hated by everyone on account of my name. In John 15:19, he says, because you are not of the world, but I chose you out of the world, therefore the world hates you. Same thought, same concept. I think this is the same Jesus, absolutely, and I think he is no less historical, and in fact, I would say that we have reason to believe that he said things that were recognizably like this, possibly even many of them on that night. In fact, the reference to the vines, there are vine vineyards. Yes. In Jerusalem, and he says, come on, let's go at the end of one chapter, and then they could have been passing those vineyards.
I mean, you're starting to bring in some of this area that you believe is evidence of the historical reliability of John and so on, these undesigned coincidences cross-referenced against, you know, details of the synoptic gospels here, Lydia. But we've moved, in a sense, from those I am statements and discourses, Craig, to more this farewell discourse, which just again to set the scene a little bit here, we have obviously all got the four gospel accounts contain an account of Jesus's Last Supper and the events of the crucifixion. But John's gospel gives Jesus a great deal more dialogue overall within that, a lot more expansive, if you like, statements and reassurances to the disciples and so on, on that Last Supper. So, and Lydia's view is, firstly, there's no reason to assume that somehow the Synoptic Gospels are more historical because we have a more choppy, shorter sort of version of Jesus, of what Jesus says, compared to these longer, more flowing sort of statements of Jesus in John. And secondly, I think that that there's every reason to see a lot of connections between what Jesus says there in that longer discourse, as reported in John, compared to the shorter sort of moments in the Synoptic Gospels. So what's your view personally, first of all, on that farewell discourse? Again, how much do you think is, you know, could, if you had been there at the time, Jesus would have actually been saying, how much do you think is a sort of an elaboration, a paraphrase, a restatement of his teaching by a later writer or community? Where do you stand on that particular element of John's gospel?
Well, I have no reason to cast any doubt or raise any questions about the either the veracity or historicity of the Upper Room discourse. It's an intimate conversation. The disciples are all there. We have the beloved disciple, a mysterious figure, much debated among even the earliest church fathers as to who he is. And that's the sort of thing I wouldn't be surprised at all if it represents a very good synopsis verbally and so forth of things Jesus said. Even it would represent only a small portion of what was said during those long hours together that evening. But there is an important point. This is where I do disagree with Lydia, and I think this is ultimately most of the issue that's behind this discussion and her criticism of me, and it's just the understanding of how the Gospels were composed. It's not so much a question of historicity or veracity, it's just understanding how they're composed. And I go back to what she said about these longer discourses in Matthew. the problem here is these discourses have been constructed out of disparate materials. And she mentioned the Sermon on the Mount. That's a great example of it. When you look at Luke, the parallel there, and it's half a chapter. It's Luke chapter 6, verses 20 to 49, the so-called Sermon on the Plain. And in Matthew, it becomes three chapters, 5, 6, and 7. And all critical scholars of the synoptics, and I mean evangelicals, not just, you know, non-evangelicals, recognize this assembling, this constructing of these discourses out of materials. And if Lydia rejects that and says, no, that's not what happened, it's, you know, it's a recording of what Jesus said on one particular occasion, she's very much out of step with critical gospel scholarship at that point. Maybe she does not understand, you know, the views that most of us hold to, mark and priority, the existence of a collection of Jesus' sayings, which Matthew and Luke, independently of one another, used and supplemented their mark and narrative in creating their own Gospels of Matthew and Luke. So I think there's a major difference between us there, and I think that lays the foundation for some of this these disagreements on other features that reach out and touch John as well.
I'd like to address that, if I may, and clarify what I do and don't understand. Would that be okay?
Go ahead.
First of all, actually, I've explicitly, right here in this conversation, repeatedly raised the possibility of composite discourses, both for Matthew and for John. I am open to either possibility there, that it could be either composite or non-composite. I actually tend to think that critical scholars, of whose views I am aware that Greg is mentioning, are pretty definite on, you know, what is composite and what is not. But I think, if anything, critical scholars need to be a little more open to the possibility that something may have happened or been said recognizably all at a given time. But I'm not going to be dogmatic about that at all. I'm certainly aware of the two-source hypothesis. I'm also aware of more and less rigid versions thereof. I'm also aware of arguments for example, Matthean authorship. And unfortunately, the fairly rigid notion of mark and priority is sometimes used to not allow Matthew to have his own access to these events and actually be adding eyewitness material. I have evidence that he did so from undesigned coincidences, but and the same way with John. But I am not at all unaware of the notion of a composite discourse. However, again, in other statements that Dr. Craig has, or Dr. Evans has made, he has cast additional doubt on John, more particularly and especially for these sayings here in this conversation, more for the I am sayings, followed by a predicate in the earlier conversation with Dr. Ehrman, it encompassed the I am sayings without a predicate, like before Abraham was, I am, or the statement, I and the Father are one, that there's something especially questionable about these, and here he seemed to emphasize that it's because they're embedded in long discourses. In fact, the possibility of a composite discourse actually means that there's no more reason to attribute that to the Johannine community than any other portion of the gospel, because if one thinks that it might be to some extent a composite of things Jesus said at another time, then it's not the product of later reflection on the part of the Johannine community. Jesus might very well have said, I am the vine, or I am the bread of life. I just wanted to mention concerning the bread of life, Craig Blomberg has a very interesting discussion of that as a Jesus engaging in a midrash on an ancient Hebrew text, not someone else inventing what Jesus said. And he says at least that since Jesus was a rabbi and this supposedly took place in a synagogue, that would be a very appropriate setting for this kind of show of rabbinic knowledge on Jesus' part in the Bread of Life discourse. So I really think that what I'm chiefly pushing for right at this moment is a greater openness to the possibility that, these things were uttered at a given time, but I am certainly not at all unaware of critical scholarly views on these matters.
And in that sense, Lydia, you're saying, okay, maybe there's composite sort of stuff going on. You're fully aware of what the critics say, but you want the critics, as it were, to be more open to the idea of the long dialogues and parts of John's gospel being genuine, you know, that they're based on the historical sayings of Jesus, what he said in particular settings and places. And you're concerned that, for instance, quoting from what Craig said in one of those dialogues with Bart Ehrman's, when Craig, for instance, said, "I would be very surprised if we caught him, as in Jesus, uttering, 'I am this and I am that,'" and one of those big
lines. Exactly. I think we would have caught him uttering, "I am this and I am that." And I don't see any reason to cast doubt on that historically, even if it does occur in a longer discourse, but sometimes it doesn't occur in a longer discourse.
I mean, let's allow Craig just then to clarify. I mean, Craig, I think we're coming back to the original question which we began with, which is, are you actually saying Jesus didn't actually say, "I am the bread of life, I am the light of the world, I am the way, the truth, and the life"? That these things didn't come from the mouth of Jesus, but rather they were this crea, this kind of elaboration of his teaching by the community or person who wrote the Gospel of John. Obviously, Lydia feels there's no need to go that far. You don't have to. There's no reason to treat the Gospel of John so differently from the synoptics in these sorts of statements. But if you are saying that he didn't actually say those things, You've gone far further than you need to. You've cast more scepticism upon these the historical reliability of these statements than you need to. So go ahead, Craig. What's your response there?
It begins with a series of observations. We don't find the I Am discourses in Matthew, Mark, or Luke. We just don't. And we have three Gospels. We have a pretty broad coverage of Jesus's teaching and activities. Sure, of course, we don't think that Matthew, Mark, and Luke contain everything Jesus said and did. And so the fact that John comes along and has materials, sayings, and deeds that are not recorded in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, that's not in itself problematic. But it is strange that a style of teaching that is commonplace in John is not represented in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And so that's the first observation that's made. So we have the I Am discourses in John. We don't have equivalents in the synoptics. First observation. The second one is the I Am way of speaking. I am this and I am that, various attributes, is a feature that we find in wisdom tradition, both inside canonical scripture and outside in the approximate time of, you know, the century or two leading up to the church. And so that then makes us wonder, maybe John is taking Jesus's teaching, which you do find in the synoptics, including teaching that perhaps is not found in the synoptics, that's unique to that southern perspective in the Johannine community, and taking that teaching and presenting it in as though Jesus is wisdom speaking. And so there is some creativity, much more creativity than we see in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. So when we look at the handbooks for education in antiquity and historiography, we realize that that fits within it, even if it's at the edges of it. So I would have to ask Lydia, does she allow for paraphrase? Jesus seems to be teaching his disciples that way in his own example, where he repeats parables and other things in various settings, and they're a little bit different. And so Jesus seems able to restate his own teaching, paraphrase his own teaching. Matthew 13:52 seems to be an instruction that his disciples do that. So does Lydia allow for paraphrase? Can the evangelist, is it legitimate? Have they been instructed to adapt and paraphrase Jesus's teaching, even expand it? And if the answer to those questions is, well, yes, well, then maybe that does help explain, not everything, but at least some things with respect to the Gospel of John. And if she goes that far, then I think we basically are on the same page, even if we might differ here or there as we work our way through each passage.
Just 1 minute to respond, and we'll have to go to our final break, Lydia.
Okay, wow, that's a lot to respond to. First of all, I think we need to be really careful not to misuse the word paraphrase. If Jesus never uttered the bread of life discourse in some recognizable fashion, I'll just pick that one, where he's comparing himself to the bread of life, then that's, and then John, or the author of John, wrote up an entire discourse that it did not occur in any historically recognizable fashion. I would say that it's not a paraphrase. I think we need to use the word paraphrase in a way that's more recognizable. Secondly, I would say that I certainly disagree with Craig's interpretation of that verse in Matthew about bringing out things old and new. And in fact, the author of John often distinguishes between what the disciples understood later and what Jesus actually uttered at the time. So I think he's actually pretty scrupulous about that. So, sure, I would allow paraphrase in the normal sense of paraphrase, but not in this extremely expansive and, I would say, idiosyncratic way that certain scholars are using it, that I think people don't understand, that what they mean by paraphrase could be making up an entire discourse that never historically occurred. That, I really just don't see that we have any reason to believe the authors did.
And in terms of Craig's question that he particularly wanted you to answer, do you believe Jesus gave permission for people to elaborate on, paraphrase and interpret his teachings, and that's effectively what's happened in the Synoptic and in John's Gospel?
Well, I would say he wants them to teach, and the Holy Spirit comes to guide them to teach, but there's a big difference between their teaching as apostles, using their authority as apostles, and he gave them that for a reason, and their teaching in such a way as to make it appear that Jesus himself actually made the statements. Those are different things, and they have to be kept distinct. In fact, Ben Witherington has noted that the Holy Spirit is seen as a source of continuing revelation in John 14, but it's not confused with the role of reminding the disciples what Jesus himself has said during his earthly ministry. So I think those need to be kept distinct. Certainly they were to teach the early church, but I don't see them teaching by making up discourses that Jesus never said, and then putting them into the mouth of Jesus. I just don't see a reason to believe that they did that.
We're going to go to our final break, and we'll conclude this discussion, a high-level discussion, really, on the nature of the Gospel of John and the way that it elaborates on the words of Jesus, the way it presents them. Does it present a historically accurate picture of Jesus, we're asking today on the programme? My guests are Craig Evans and Lydia McGrew, and we'll be back with the final part of their discussion in just a moment.
Believers and non-believers will all be helped, says Tim Keller, a wonderfully clear and accessible case for Christianity, from a man who has hosted many of the world's most prominent skeptics and atheists, says Andrew Wilson. Beautifully written, brilliantly argued, will thrill and challenge, says R.T. Kendall. Unbelievable, the book by Justin Brierley. Download a free chapter and find out how it can help you make the case for Christ. Unbelievablebook.co.uk.
Welcome back to the third and final part of this week's Unbelievable here on Premier Christian Radio as part of Faith Explored, hosted by myself, Justin Brierley, and we'll be hearing the final part of the conversation between Craig Evans and Lydia McGrew very shortly. Coming straight up after them here on the show towards the end of today's programme, Johnny Somerville talks about his new film series, Newer. You'll be hearing all about that and how he's engaging young minds in the claims of Christianity. Straight after Unbelievable today on The Profile, Bob Fu talks about his life as a pastor who escaped persecution in China as part of the underground church. Fascinating conversation. That's between 4 and 5 this afternoon, or on its own Profile podcast if you want to go and start downloading that. It's a really interesting weekly exploration of different Christians' faith and life. Next week on the show, highlights from Unbelievable the Conference 2018. That's what you can look forward to. And all those who are gathered at this weekend's conference are going to be hearing about our special Big Conversation series starting very soon on the 9th of June. And it will mark the beginning of a series, a special video series as well, exploring science, faith, philosophy, and what it means to be human. This is a unique video series featuring world-class thinkers across the Christian and atheist community. People like Jordan B. Peterson and Susan Blackmore in Conversation on the Psychology of Belief, Steven Pinker and Nick Spencer, Darren Brown and Richard Coles, John Lennox and Michael Roos, Daniel Dennett and Keith Ward, Peter Singer and Andy Bannister. It's going to be really great, and we're going to be releasing the teaser promo video this coming week. You'll be able to access that via the Facebook and Twitter of Unbelievable, via our YouTube stream. And indeed, we'll be putting out a little special podcast announcement about that special series and how you can get involved. Sign up to the Unbelievable newsletter that we're launching, and lots more besides. There's going to be a special event happening on July the 18th when you can take part in a live audience edition of Unbelievable with John Lennox and Michael Roos in conversation. So there's lots to look forward to. Look out for the special announcement on your podcast and in future editions of the show here on Premier Christian Radio as we tell you all about that and how to get involved in the big conversation. Right now, it's time to hear the final part of today's debate.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Well, we're concluding today's programme as we ask, does John's Gospel present a historically accurate picture of Jesus? There's been a lot of ink spilled and a lot of debates had over the nature of John's Gospel compared to the synoptics, Matthew, Mark and Luke, and the way in which he presents Jesus and the words of Jesus there. And Craig Evans, a distinguished New Testament scholar, has been talking to us on the programme today about the way he conceives of the way that John is set out and what the purposes were of those who wrote down the life teachings and sayings of Jesus there, and says and agrees with our other guest, Lydia McGrew, that there's an awful lot of valuable historical data in the Gospel of John, but that we do have to treat the way that they present the sayings of Jesus in a somewhat different way to the synoptics. There's more elaboration, there's more kreia, in a way, going on. That's the technical term for this way of paraphrasing, elaborating on, and retelling the teachings of Jesus. Lydia McGrew is concerned that scholars like Craig have been too quick to dismiss the historicity of the sayings of Jesus in the Gospel of John, and she's already spoken a little bit about the ways in which she thinks there's actually a great deal of historical basis for some of these, for various of the sayings there. And just in that last section, again, I think Lydia was essentially restating some of her concerns, Craig, that she feels that you know, that there's no reason to cast so much doubt on these particular sayings that we're entitled to take from John, you know, the same sorts of lessons that we do from a lot of the synoptics. And while we're not saying these are verbatim, that these are essentially, if we go the lengths of saying these were actually effectively made up, Jesus never said anything in any historical context akin to the I am statements, then we've got a problem on our hands. And she just doesn't see that we have to go down that route. And I think you're a bit more prepared to go down that route to say it's yes, it is more than possible that Jesus never actually made the I am statements. And these are effectively not made up, but rather these are extrapolations, if you like, of Jesus' teaching by the Johannine community or author of John. And so is it just a fact that you are prepared to simply go a bit further than her on that basis, Craig?
I suppose so. You could put it that way. It's just that we can say John the Evangelist has a different writing style and a different agenda, you know, and Matthew, Mark, and Luke have their respective agendas. But the point is, we're still talking about Jesus. And so you have virtually nothing. I think there's a few verses in Matthew 11, which could be exceptional. Virtually nothing in Matthew, Mark, and Luke that sounds like and looks like Jesus in the Gospel of John. So we have to ask as historians at this point, is there just some other Jesus we didn't know about? Does Jesus just simply behave and talk very differently in some circumstances, maybe when he's down south, when he's in Samaria, Judea, in and out of Jerusalem and Bethany? Or is it a lot more to do with the way the evangelist chooses to write the story? And I opt with the latter. I think it's the same Jesus, and I think he's presented very differently. And I guess I'm counting votes. It's 3-1. Matthew, Mark, and Luke present him a certain way. John presents him in a very different way. And I suspect, given the parallels with wisdom literature, for example, that John is presenting Jesus in a much more interpretive light. He's being more aggressive in the paraphrasing, the theological expansion. Extrapolation is a good word, too. It's dramatic, it's literary, but that doesn't mean the history is lost or that it no longer reflects what Jesus actually taught. Sometimes the analogy I use is the parables. Jesus taught in parables, especially if we're looking at Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And by the way, the parables as such don't even appear in John. But throughout Matthew, Mark, and Luke, Jesus's teaching is characterized by parables. Mark actually says Jesus did not teach without parables. And parables are fictions. Some of them are very realistic and reflect the way people behave. Some of them don't. But the point is, Jesus's greatest teaching is on the kingdom of God, who God is and how we should live, is presented in parables. And in a sense, that's what John is doing. Now, I wouldn't say John's parable, it's not a fiction, but what John's doing is taking Jesus's teaching and his activities. And I would agree with the idea that the Holy Spirit deepens the understanding of John and the other disciples of Jesus, especially in the post-Easter setting. And so he's presenting with hindsight Jesus as the very incarnation of God, the very incarnation of God's wisdom, and expansively interpreting Jesus' sayings in light of that.
And just before Lydia comes back in, one question that's been buzzing around my mind while you've been speaking there, Craig, is a lot of skeptics listen to this program. A lot of skeptics who, in a sense, you know, may be really interested, intrigued, and even want there to be as much, if you like, difference between what the historical Jesus may have said and what the Gospels actually report him to have said. And I can imagine some of them right now saying, well, if a Christian like Craig expects me to accept Jesus as my Lord and Savior on the basis of what he said about himself, who he claimed to be, how can I possibly do that if I can't be certain he actually did say any of these things about I am the way, the truth, and the life, I am the good shepherd, I am the light of the world? What's your response to that? Because I think that is the problem that I think Lydia sees, is if what you're potentially doing is undermining the deistic claims of Jesus and his lordship, therefore.
Well, what I would say is that we have Jesus's divinity expressed in all four Gospels in different ways. And we have his divinity expressed by those who knew him, talk about him, witnessed him as the risen Lord, particularly Paul, for example. And so the New Testament as a whole bears witness to Jesus's divinity, to his saving ministry, his saving death on the cross, his resurrection. And so it doesn't just ride on the Gospel of John and sayings we find there, however we are to understand their development and how they came to come into this form that we have them in John. If we understand the whole witness of the New Testament, if we understand, and I think we do now much better, the high Christology of the Synoptic Gospels, then we do recognize we're in a position to say that what we find in John is not unbelievable, it's not a distortion, it's not fiction, but truly does represent what Jesus taught.
Thank you so much, Craig. Lydia, let's come to you and we'll start to wrap things up. What does that allay any of your concerns in any way?
I'd like to say just a couple of things and wrap up here that I think will be interesting to the audience. First of all, earlier in this conversation, I kind of pinned Craig down a little bit concerning specifically the incident where Jesus has a dialogue with the Jews and then he says, before Abraham was, I am, and they try to stone him and asked him, did that incident occur recognizably in history, separate from anything in the synoptics? And at that time, he said yes, that he thought it did, which was very different from what he appeared to be saying in 2012. Now here toward the end of our program, he seems to be coming back and sort of taking that back again, because when he talks about I am and the use of the term I am, quote-unquote, being Jesus talking like wisdom, there's really no reason to apply that then to I am the bread of life or I am the way, the truth, and the life, but to say that when he says before Abraham was, I am, he's that really historically occurred. So I don't think that I don't think that in the past Craig has drawn a sharp distinction between those, and I doubt that he really means even now to draw a sharp distinction between those. So I feel that there is still some real ambiguity about where he's coming from concerning the recognizable historicity, again, not verbatim, but of a couple of those strong claims to deity that Jesus makes in John. And I just want to draw attention to that ambiguity. Then the next thing I want to address is his statement that John presents Jesus as so different. And I completely disagree with that. I think the nature and personality of Jesus are clearly the same in all four Gospels. And I have many, many examples of this, but here in the time we have, I can't give them in detail. But his use of sarcasm, his modes of thought, his rapier-sharp wit, his love for his friends, his weeping with compassion, his ability to read thoughts, even his characteristic metaphors and turns of phrase, his use of object lessons, John's presentation of Jesus is actually very strikingly the same as the synoptics. And the differences between them are exaggerated and incorrectly stated by critical scholarship. By the use of vivid vignettes, John shows us not an allegorical abstraction, but a solid and intensely real person, and he is the same person whom we meet in the Synoptic Gospels, and we can tell that by reading them. That's not just something we believe by faith. That's actually right there in the text and in the documents. And I've been enjoying doing some research on that and discovering how that's true in great detail.
I'm just going to give you both just 30 seconds for a final thought before we close out today's show. I'll start with you, Craig.
Well, I think that's not a very realistic understanding of John, and that's the reason why the vast majority of scholars don't see it that way. John does present Jesus in a very different way. I agree that it is the same Jesus, but the portraits in John and the Synoptics are very different, and I think we should take that difference into account. And just to assert that it's the same thing just won't do it.
Thank you very much for joining me today, Craig. If you want more about Craig and his work, craigaevans.com. Final word to you, Lydia, just as we close out. Again, if you could keep it to 30 seconds or less.
As far as the vast majority of scholars, I certainly think that we need to consider the democracy of the dead when we're considering this here. C.S. Lewis compared John's portrait of Jesus to Boswell's Life of Johnson, which was certainly a very close-up, very historical memoir. Of course, I'm not simply asserting that they're the same. I have pages and pages of examples, such as Jesus' way of talking about Sabbath controversies in Luke 13 and in John 7. They're different Sabbath controversies, and yet his wit and his what I would call conceptual punning is exactly the same. Even his physical gestures, the way he looks up to heaven when he prays. So I actually have many examples. I'm not simply asserting this. And this was noted by older scholars on numerous occasions. I've been enjoying a book by Stanley Leaves, Leathes, from the 19th century, where he has pages and pages and pages of parallels between the Synoptic and the Johannine Jesus. So this is actually supportable by very concrete data that the portrait is actually has an enormous amount of overlap, and that John's own differences of linguistic style should not be allowed to obscure that.
Well, thank you both for joining me on the program today. Thank you for what was obviously a spirited disagreement on the nature and of exactly what's going on with the Gospel of John. But I do so appreciate you both coming on to take the time to talk about it. So, Craig and Lydia, thank you for joining me on today's program.
You're most welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Look forward to hearing back from you. You can email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Let me know your thoughts that way. Facebook.com/unbelievablejb is the Facebook account for the show. Or you can tweet me @unbelievablejb if that's your preferred method of doing it. And there's going to be more ways in which you can engage with the show coming up soon. We're going through a season of change here on Unbelievable, where we're starting some exciting new ventures, not least the Big Conversation series. And that's sort of the catalyst, really, for sort sort of relaunching a YouTube channel for the show and keeping you engaged with the show via a special Unbelievable newsletter. I'm going to be talking about that more on next week's show, and we've got some special announcements in a podcast edition of the show as well in the coming week as we clue you into all of that stuff. But lots to look forward to on the show. And although we haven't got a lot of time for your feedback this week, last week's show was just a fascinating engagement between New Testament scholar Paula Gooder and a skeptical Bible scholar Francesca Stavrakopoulou on the question, is Christianity sexist? Looking at some of the issues around women in leadership and the example of women in the early church. David Robertson, who's a friend of the show, a minister at St. Peter's Free Church and the founder of the Solas Center for Public Christianity, says, thanks for that latest edition of Unbelievable. I found it fascinating, although I felt it was a bit one-sided, with Paula willing to grant far too many of Francesca's presuppositions and statements. To be honest, it was a bit like listening to a debate about Brexit with two Remainers, chaired by a Remainer, in which they talk about Brexiteers rather than let them speak for themselves. However, I did find it a fascinating programme. I'm also taken by the item at the end about out of the question and teen apologetics. I'm currently on sabbatical in Sydney, writing an apologetic slash devotional book for 15 to 17 year olds, and I've received hundreds of questions from all over the world from teenagers, and I'm responding to 52 of them in the book. And I agree completely with Ruth Jackson, who said this is an area which has been much neglected. It's also fascinating that worldwide questions are not the same for this age group. Look forward to seeing more about that book in due course, David. I'm sure you'll come on to talk about it as well when it's ready. Well, speaking of apologetics resources that are suitable for youth groups and young people, have a listen to this.
For me, explaining what I do often causes an interesting reaction. I talk to people about God and faith. Now, sometimes I love this because it opens up a conversation about what we believe, and other times I dread it because I'm afraid of being labelled a fanatic or a holy Joe.
The arguments made against the existence of God are everywhere.
Books, websites, and all sorts of people can be quite vocal about it. I want to present the other side of the story and start an honest conversation about questions of faith and belief that we all struggle with. So let's start with a question.
How did we get here? Or better yet, how did all this get here?
Well, what you heard there was just a little bit of a taster of a new film series, Newer, that is being used across Ireland and now across the world. And it's the brainchild of Johnny Somerville, who joins me in studio now to talk about the Newer film series. Johnny is actually going to be at Unbelievable, the conference 2018 on Saturday, the 19th of May. He'll be in the exhibitors area and you'll be able to watch and talk about and find out more about the Newer film series. That's N-U-A. Johnny, welcome along to the programme.
Yeah, thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
You've flown in from Ireland.
Just for you.
Not really, not really. I know you're doing other stuff, but it's great to actually have you in person. It's always nice to meet people face to face. We've been talking in advance of this interview about the Newer film series. But for those who have not the foggiest, what Newer is, can you just quickly encapsulate what it's all about?
I suppose Newer, the best way to think about Newer is apologetics for normal people, or maybe not just for normal people. I suppose being a youth worker for so long in Ireland, using the Alpha for so long, there was these kind of identified questions that kept coming up, and they...
Which weren't quite being addressed by the material you were using at that time.
Yeah, it was like Alpha was a taster to a couple of things, and I think young people were looking for more. And so we thought, particularly as an Alpha follow-on, that a course which really scratched the itch of some of these questions, that if we created something, that it would be well-received. And so that's what we did.
And you've created eight of them, all addressing kind of a central question.
For sure, yeah. So it's taking science and faith a lot further, the credibility of the scriptures, conspiracy theories against the resurrection, you know, the history of the church, God and suffering. A lot of, I suppose, the classic kind of objections to the Christian faith are just where young people are really struggling with, and young adults, when it comes to understanding God and religion.
And I can vouch for the fact that these are really nicely well produced. I mean, there's a lot of not so good Christian content out there, but the Newer series, you've really actually gone for, you've really invested in the look and feel of these films.
Yeah, yeah. I feel a very privileged person, particularly as an Irishman. It's not often that a resource like this will come out of Ireland, or to get such backing that we did financially to make sure that we could do it as best that we could. So we recorded in around Ireland, over in Israel and in the States as well. We wanted to have an international feel. We wanted to record on location as well, a little bit.
So you can talk about Jesus in Jerusalem.
For sure,
where he walked the streets and that kind of thing.
So like, it's in many ways, from my perspective, it is a miracle that it exists at all.
Yeah, Well, it does. It looks fantastic, I've got to say that. But obviously, it's the content is what it's all about as well. And so were you finding when you, in your youth work role that you needed a resource like this to kind of spark conversation, to help young people who are Christians know what they believe, and, sure. and I guess to help engage people who have those questions?
Yeah, and I suppose it's not leaving... It's not leaving apologetics just for college.
Yeah,
I think young people, I think it's actually, particularly in Ireland, young people are open and they want to have that conversation. And so by no means, I don't want to take advantage of young people with maybe more impressionable minds, but it's opening them up to the credibility of Christianity and just the compelling nature of Christ.
And you do that as well as having the film series, which can be downloaded or bought or whatever. There's a kind of study material that goes along with it. Again, it looks fantastic. It's really engaging. It's got space for obviously people making notes. It's got a lot of the quotes from the films and so on. And what have you seen happening when young people have started using this? Because it's not just in churches. I think there's been schools that have been taking up this material as well.
Yeah, schools are unique in Ireland. Religious education is still so strong. And there's actually non-examined religious education for your last 2 years of secondary school. And so NUA is a perfect resource to supplement the curriculum. And the feedback that we've been getting just recently, because we've been doing a feedback initiative, has been really encouraging. Just to hear, like, there's a religious education teacher who said it was the best resource they've used in their 20 years trying to teach religious education. And there was a young ORE teacher only yesterday who said that it was the most skeptical young people in his room that were most engaged throughout the course. And so it's just it's really encouraging to know that it is connecting.
Yeah.
And even with maybe the young people who would be, I don't know, slow to speak up.
So it was conceived, developed, and kind of originated in Ireland, but now it's been released in Canada, the USA, and now you're obviously wanting to make sure that the rest of the British Isles know about.
Yeah, for sure. As in, Scripture Union it's an interdenominational Christian charity. It's in 120 countries around the world. So we worked as hard as we could to script those. It took us a year to script them. There was about 30 critiquers and contributors. And we also filmed it with an international kind of audience in mind. And so as long as I'm being employed at Scripture Union, I want to make sure that I can just expose and let people know that it's there as a really helpful tool to engage with young people and young adults.
So the ways that people can get hold of NUA is obviously via the website, nuafilmseries.org, N-U-A. By the way, where does that come from?
It's an Irish word. It simply means new.
Right.
I suppose, like, when you try and name things, as you know, it's very difficult to name anything. So it's kind of a bit vague.
Yeah.
But it is. It's a new look.
Exactly. And it kind of actually, because it's a bit unusual, it makes you stop and think, oh, what is that exactly? But yeah, love it. Nuafilmseries.org. You can get it on a USB stick if that's your preferred way of getting hold of it. There's the guide, there's a journal, and so on. And as I say, these 8 episodes that you can take people through. I guess this is not just schools, though. It's obviously youth groups, it's small groups, it's all those kinds of
I even visited
ways.
A prison last week in Dublin. I was shocked to hear that it was actually being used in a prison.
That's fantastic.
It's been used quite universally. It's not just for young people. That was the main aim, that kind of 18-year-old.
And what might a session look like if you're sitting down, say, you know, with episode 1, how did we get here? Is it you whack the video on and simply have a discussion afterwards?
Yeah, it's 15 minutes of content and split into 3. So it's more whack 5 minutes on and have a good discussion and then
we'll whack the next.
Yeah. So it's you don't have to take too much in one go.
Right. That's really helpful. And you're covering a lot of bases in that sense, because you're starting with, you know, why are we here at all? Then you're moving on to Jesus and various aspects of that. But then that whole question of how can you say that God is good, the question of suffering and so on. So, what are you trying to... Because obviously in 15 minutes, you're not going to be able to answer all the questions that are out there. What's the aim in terms of what you're actually presenting? And do you have to be, I suppose, a specialised apologist to be able to carry out, you know, to actually run one of these sessions?
No, I think there's 2 main aims. The first one is to encourage the young believer, particularly in a Western culture where it is difficult to believe or make a defense for your faith. We want to encourage young people that Christianity is credible. It's not blind faith, so to speak. And then at the same time, we want NUA to be very engaging for the skeptic. We want it to be a stumbling block, I suppose, in the minds of many people. So it's not dogmatic. It seeks to present really credible points, but ultimately we encourage the viewer to make their own mind up. But yeah, we want it to I suppose, bring that credibility, but also point to the compelling nature of Christ. Because it can't just be apologetics by itself. If it doesn't impact the heart, or at least ask for a response of some sort, then it may not be as fruitful.
Yeah. So just some of the comments I'm seeing you've had from young people on this. This was a great one. I had very concrete ideas about my faith, but Nua made me look at religion from a different perspective. And another who said that Nua helped me to develop the link between science and religion and how they work together. So I guess even in 15 minutes, you can make a big dent and make a big difference, I suppose, especially through the conversation.
And also just to help young people chat with young people.
Yeah, absolutely.
And even to give maybe some that have faith in the classroom that extra little bit of confidence to speak up and chat.
Well, if you want a little preview of it, go and watch the very good trailer for the newer film series over at the website. Again, if you want to give us the website, what is it again?
It's newerfilmseries.org. And episode one is now there as well. So you can check out a whole episode.
It might be something you're interested in running in your church, your youth group, your small group, or wherever. For the moment, thank you very much for joining me on the program today.
Thank you, Justin. Pleasure.
You're unbelievable.
Well, thanks for being with me on this week's edition of Unbelievable. And come back next week for highlights of this year's Unbelievable Conference 2018. Plus, in the coming week, if you're a listener via the podcast, look out for some special news about our forthcoming Big Conversation series and how you can get engaged with that and updated with the very latest from Unbelievable in a whole new way. I look forward to revealing more about that in the coming weeks, but for the moment, thanks for being with me on today's edition of the show. And coming up is The Profile with former underground Chinese church leader Bob Fu. You've been listening to the Unbelievable podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Podbean, or any other podcasting software, and find out more about our other Premier podcasts at premier.org.uk/podcasts.